Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, evening, everyone. This is Carl from the ISF podcast. Nice to have you with us. Today, we're going to be talking to a gentleman that I know quite well. His name is Sam Irvin. Sam is a director, producer, and writer of film. And welcome, Sam. Thank you very much for coming in.
Hey, Carl. I'm glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Well, you know, it's a really good thing in terms of what you do and so on and so forth. ISF, Incredibly Strange Films, since I've started this group, we have so many people, and we use this particular podcast to introduce people in the industry and what they do and so on and so forth. So tell me a little bit about your background, how you got in on this and so on and so forth, how you started.
Well,
I was
born and raised in Asheville, North Carolina, and my dad owned movie theaters. So movie theaters were my playground from the very youngest age, and I started seeing, you know, from the age of like 5 years old, I would see like Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe movies and Hammer films with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, Dracula, Frankenstein, all of that from the youngest age. And I just absolutely fell in love with horror films. And but I liked all kinds of films, really all genres, but horror in particular. And then when I was 8 years old, in 1964, our family took a cross-country road trip to California, and because my dad had connections in the movie business, we got a VIP tour at Warner Brothers Studios, and I was able to go on to the set of Blake Edwards' The Great Race, where I watched them shoot an iceberg sequence in a huge tank of water with Jack Lemmon,
wow,
Tony Curtis, and Natalie Wood. And then I got to see some of the shooting of Two on a Guillotine with Dean Jones and Connie Stevens. And the whole day there, just absolutely, my eyes popped right out of my head. And I decided on that day at 8 years old that I wanted to direct movies. And I took my father's 8mm home movie camera out of his hands that I don't think I ever gave it back. And ironically, you know, meeting Connie Stevens that day, literally 50 years later, I directed her daughter, Jolie Fisher, in a thriller for the Lifetime Channel called Fatal Acquittal. So there was something in the air that was just really magical, and it was really great to go full circle. But that's how things kind of got started. And then as a teenager, I edited and published my own fanzine on horror films called Bizarre. And as a high school graduation present, I bamboozled my parents into sending me to London so I could interview all of my idols in horror film and that worked, you know, with Hammer films and all that kind of stuff. And I had lunch with Christopher Lee at Pinewood Studios, and he was there shooting The Man with the Golden Gun, the James Bond movie. And he invited me to spend the afternoon watching them shoot that. So I got to meet Roger Moore and Britt Eklund and Maude Adams, and then got a ride back to London with Christopher Lee and Hervé Villechaize, who was very drunk and telling us all kinds of terrible stories about the prostitutes he'd hired since he had come to London, and had us all just howling with laughter in the back of the Rolls Royce limousine. And then I wanted to interview Diana Rigg, who I was a huge fan of, and she was in the Avengers TV series in the 60s as Emma Peel, and she was in the James Bond movie on Her Majesty's Secret Service. She's the only Bond girl to have married Bond. And then she was in Theater of Blood as Vincent Price's daughter. And so I went to the theater she was playing on the West End in Pygmalion. And I was going to go see the show and then go to the stage door and see if I could meet her and get an interview. And I sit down in my seat, and I turn around, and there is Vincent Price sitting right behind me. I had gotten to meet Vincent Price several times when he would be on tour, doing his lecture tours and stuff, because I was such a huge super fan. So he knew me, and he immediately said, "Sam, what are you doing here?" And I said, "I want to interview Diana Rigg." And he said, "Well, you're coming backstage with me after the show." And so he introduced me to her, and she granted me the interview. And it was just like all these magical things were happening. And
That's outstanding. Now, one thing I have to say is that Diana Rigg made my puberty so much more manageable. The second thing I'd like to say is now we have my co-host. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, everybody. I just want to say that
Rachel,
that's probably the longest I've successfully been quiet in maybe ever. I don't know.
Rachel, it's very special for Rachel because she has her Taco Tuesday socks on.
I do. I have a pretty fantastic socks collection, and I consider my good luck socks to be the ones that are appropriate for the day. Like my Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees socks are the ones that I wear most days. Because, you know, sometimes you just got to kill a foal.
Exactly.
So, yeah, today's Taco Tuesday, and I just have to say, like, sorry if I sound like a little fangirl here, but I was recently introduced to you, Mr. Irvin, and I have been so, so stoked to be able to do this today. So, I'm very
Doc,
excited.
If you're listening, I think it's time for Rachel's confession. Are we ready?
Uh-oh. Which confession? I might need a reminder on this one.
Yes, just think Santa Claus.
Oh, yes. Okay, so there's some interesting stuff with that. So first off, I discovered that my partner has a deep-seated and unspoken love for Christmas movies. We spent a lot of time this weekend at like 3 o'clock in the morning watching Christmas movies. But I'm not entirely sure which confession we're talking about here. I actually have some questions from one of the Christmas movies that I watched. Not confession.
Well, go right ahead, Rachel. That's why you're my co-host. Go for it.
Okay, so this is a really silly question, but it really I feel like I'm maybe okay to ask this because I am a woman, and this is never a question you want to hear. And I want to say that the filming was great. Now, this was in the movie Naughty or Nice, or Naughty and Nice.
Okay.
Sorry.
Naughty and Nice, yes.
Okay. First off, I've noticed that in a lot of your movies, which I personally really, really appreciate, that even if it's just in a background scene, there's LGBTQ representation, and I just have to go ahead and get that out of the way and say, hands down, thank you for that.
Nice. Thank you. I very much strive to do that.
I kind of noticed. I did. So I just really appreciate that. And I know there's a lot of people out there that when I show them these movies and stuff are going to be like, oh, I see it. This is awesome. I've seen a few of your movies, but my second thing I have to ask here, and this might be what Carl is talking about. What is the deal with your packing peanuts obsession?
Well, it kind of dates back to the movie I did called Out There. And
I know.
It was a sci-fi.
That's where it started.
Yes, exactly. And it was a sci-fi comedy that I did for the Showtime Network in 1995. And it had the most incredible cast of people. It starred Billy Campbell from The Rocketeer, Oscar winner Rod Steiger, Oscar winner Billy Bob Thornton. And we had a third Oscar winner. If you blink, you missed her. But Jennifer Connelly is a non-speaking extra standing next to me in a grocery line right behind Bill Campbell and Julie Brown. She was Bill Campbell's co-star in The Rocketeer. And they were still dating when we did our movie, and she was visiting the set all the time. And I said, Jennifer, you just got to be in the movie. Come here and stand with me in this grocery line. And she said, sure. So she's even in it.
That is fantastic.
Anyway, the movie, I mean, it's a bit of a spoiler, but basically the aliens in the movie, when they hear accordion music, they explode into packing popcorn peanuts.
Well, I'm just remembering the scene, and this is where it started in my brain, because I am going to say it was probably at a very early / very late hour in the evening. I have some insomnia issues, so I love to sit around and watch movies all the time. It was the VW Bug when they opened the door, and the whole thing is stuffed with packing peanuts.
Yes, from floor to ceiling. There were like three or four aliens, you know, on a chase scene inside a little VW Bug, and they come down an alley, and the humans who know what their, you know, Achilles heel is are all there with a whole row of accordions, and they start playing the accordions like crazy, and then boom,
they got straight weird owled into the afterlife on that one.
What's that?
I said they got straight Weird Al'd into the afterlife on that one.
Exactly. Anyway, if you have Amazon Prime, you can actually stream out there for free right now, anytime. So you should check it out. It's a really fun film, and it also has Julie Brown from Earth Girls Are Easy and The Homecoming Queen's Got a Gun. It has Jill St. John, Bond Girl from Diamonds Are Forever. It has June Lockhart from Lost in Space. It's got Carl Sryken, who's Lurch in the Addams Family movies and the Giant on Twin Peaks.
It was just such an absolute gem. Like, I can't believe that I have not seen that one before, especially for my love of weird horror and sci-fi. Like, I mean, one of my favorite just weird sci-fi movies is actually Bad Taste, which is, I found out a long time ago, very hard to acquire a copy of in the U.S., but I did manage to find a playable director's cut of that a few years ago.
Nice.
And yeah, so I am entirely into that, and like I said, I'm surprised I've never seen it before. I mean, that is my wheelhouse right there.
It's awesome. Yeah, it's one of my favorites that I've done. It was really, really fun to do. And I did some other sci-fi around that time. I did Oblivion 1 and 2, which were sci-fi westerns. And they starred George Takei of Star Trek and Julie Newmar, who was the original Catwoman on the Batman series, and Isaac Hayes and Meg
Foster.
Now,
those two I know. I've never seen what was the name of it again?
Oblivion.
Not Oblivion. The other one you were talking about with the peanuts.
Out there.
I've never. So the one question I have for Out There, did the accordions play Lady in Spain?
Mostly
no,
it's
seriously.
Just an accordion weirdness.
They should have, but we couldn't have afforded the music rights. So.
Right. I figured as much. One of the worst things I ever did is I had two friends of mine, the wife, Nancy, was an accordion player, and they drugged me to an accordion band concert in Central Park to see 200 accordions play Lady of Spain. I thought I was going to die.
Oh,
not
God.
Possibly.
That is hilarious.
That is tragic.
That sounds perfectly awful.
But you can assure that there were no aliens at that meet.
No, there were not. So Sam, tell us a little bit about starting to work with Brian De Palma and how that came about.
Well, when I was going to college at the University of South Carolina, I was a huge fan of Brian De Palma's early films. He had done a film called Sisters that was very Hitchcockian. And then he had done Phantom of the Paradise, which was a rock and roll musical version of Phantom of the Opera. And I love those movies so much. Oh, and so I decided that I was head of the film committee on campus, and we ran a movie theater on campus. And I decided we were going to do a Brian De Palma Film Festival and show those and some of his other early films. And I managed to track him down and found him in at a cast by phone. And he was casting Carrie out in California. He and George Lucas were sitting at a table reading every young kid in town for Star Wars and Carrie. So everybody who came in read for both movies. It was probably the most famous casting session in all history. And they put Brian on the phone when I called. I couldn't believe it. That would never happen nowadays. And I explained what we were doing, and he agreed to come out and to South Carolina, and I took him to some film classes. He showed us how he storyboarded his movies. He was drawing storyboards on the chalkboard, and he brought a cassette tape that he was playing the brand new score to Obsession that Bernard Herrmann had just finished recording. I mean, it was just incredible. So that's how I met him. And then between my junior and senior year, he was, by then, Carrie had come out. He was now, you know, much bigger director than when I first met him, and was going to be doing a big budget film for 20th Century Fox called The Fury with Kirk Douglas and John Cassavetes, and it was a big telekinesis movie. And I called him up and said, could I come and work on that during my summer break as a production assistant? And he's said, sure. So they were shooting in Chicago. I went up there, worked on that, and I also got an assignment from Cine Fantastique magazine to write a journal on the making of the film, which allowed me to request one-on-one interviews with Kirk Douglas and all the, you know, all the big stars and everybody involved, and including during post-production, I interviewed John Williams, the composer, and Paul Hirsch, the editor who edited Star Wars, you know, just incredible experience. And so then
I'm allowed to say I'm really jealous, right?
Yeah, both of us.
So after that, I went back to school to finish my senior year. And then Brian called me just as I was graduating and said that he was going to do a low budget comedy that summer called Home Movies, and it was going to star Kirk Douglas again and Nancy Allen, who was his from Carrie, she's the one who pulls the rope for the bucket of blood, and they were a couple then. They married a few months after that, and he asked me if I wanted to come up and work on the movie, and I said yes. So I jumped on the plane right after graduation. And I figured I'd be the production assistant again or whatever. And I get up to the location and he said, you're going to be the associate producer and production manager. So I'm like, okay. He threw, throwing me into the deep end to see if I could swim. And I managed to do it. And so then he hired me full time as his assistant for several years. And I worked on mainly Dress to Kill, which was just an incredible film to work on. And I've just written, actually, a 150,000-word article on the making of Dress to Kill and all my remembrances of that that's going to be published later this month in a magazine called Boobs and Blood.
Nice.
Sounds like
editor,
a normal day at my house.
Yeah. And the editor, Miles Flanagan, I said to him, I can cut down the article to whatever length you need. And he said, no, I absolutely love it. We're going to devote the entire issue to your article and Dress to Kill. So that's going to be really fun. And that'll be coming out later this month. And part of the proceeds of his magazine goes to Breast Cancer Foundation. So it's also for a good cause. But anyway,
good causes.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No.
Well, I noticed that not only are you a wonderful director and producer and everything else, but you're also kind of a writer. Like, I say a bit prolific. You've got some awards. But I noticed that your newest one that just came out, just if I'm allowed to say this, Orbgasm, everybody. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I've been reading all about it, and Jesus Christ, you're going to want this one. I noticed before I even read about it being, let's see, it's called an erotic sci-fi pulp novel. I may not have put a series of words in there correctly, but I noticed a lot of your proceeds, or all of the proceeds from that, are going to a pretty relevant charity right now.
Yes, every penny from the sales of Orbgasm are going to the World Health Organization's COVID-19 Solidarity Response Fund. And the novel, actually, it all ties in with what we were just talking about. The movie Out There that I did for Showtime.
I was going to ask you, was the Bond girl, was that the Bond girl that was I heard that there was a Bond girl in the book. Is that who she was modeled after?
Well, yes, there is. It's a fictitious one. But the character in the book, the main female character, is an actress who had been in a Bond film. And so, but what I was going to say is that I actually wrote this originally as a screenplay that I was hoping to do with Showtime way back in the days when I did Out There for them. And it's in the same sort of spirit and mood. It has a lot of comic elements to it. And it was going to be made by Showtime. They actually optioned the script for a while, but then the regime changed at Showtime and they kind of dumped all their projects that were in development. And, you know, that's kind of showbiz for you. But the script went into a drawer for 25 years. And during this shutdown, I got, you know, I'm getting really itchy because I wasn't out directing movies. And so I pulled that script out and I turned it into a novel. And there were a lot of sexy aspects to it because it's basically about an orb that falls from outer space and lands in this woman's yard, who's an actress, as I said, who had been in a Bond film. And the orb can not only cure all diseases and everything, it also makes people very horny. And so the novel sort of, you know, I had the freedom to kind of go crazy with all the sexiness of it. And I say that when people ask me about it, I said, there's enough steamy stuff in this book to poach your eyeballs.
I have a question here. As far as Orbgasm, now, knowing that you're part of the LGBTQ community, Sam, and such, is this strictly straight or is this pansexual?
It's got a little bit for everybody. What happens in the story is that she teams up with her gay best friend, this really hunky guy named Christopher, who fictionally, he is an author who writes horror mashups. And his latest bestseller in the book is called Frankenstein and the Three Musketeers. And they team up, and because the government is trying to confiscate this orb, and they hit the road sort of Thelma and Louise style, and they're on the lam with the government chasing after them, and she wants to take the orb to her father, who has Alzheimer's, because she's convinced that the orb will cure her dad. And so they're on the run. And during this road trip, they meet various crazy characters. I think of it like it's Alice in Wonderland. You know, you got your Mad Hatter, you got your this, that, and the other along the way. And it's a lot of hard-boiled misfits that they encounter. One of them is a non-binary person named Robin, who's the Robin Hood of the dark web, and he, she, they, whatever the pronouns, they, I guess is the preferred pronoun, are, you know, have found out about this orb and wants to, you know, get involved. And there's a little of everything in this book, and it has a lot of serious aspects to it, but it's also very funny, and it's got all kinds of homages to The Bride of Frankenstein and The Birds and you name it, and it's just a fun ride.
Well, admittedly, I'm obviously not normally the co-host for this show, so when I was asked to be a part of it, I was really, really excited, but I was also caught in between projects, as it were, and did not have enough money to order the book in time for me to read it all and take notes. So I have not read it yet, but I am looking very much forward to it. And there is another one that I'm ordering at the same time. I cannot remember the whole name.
It's called Sam's Toilet Paper Caper. And this book is a parody of a children's illustrated book, like the little golden books that we all had as kids. And it's based on my true quest to find toilet paper last spring during the shutdown, when there was suddenly this inexplicable run on toilet paper everywhere. And so in real life, basically what inspired that was that, you know, I was desperate to find toilet paper, and I was in, you know, going to grocery store after grocery store, and I'd talk to the manager, and I'd be like, you know, hey, you know, Muggsy, what do you have to do to get some toilet paper around here? And, you know, it'd be like, well, we have a shipment coming in at midnight. And I felt like, you know, this feels like we're doing a drug deal to try to get toilet paper. And it just... Yeah,
that
and
happened
I,
to
thought,
us in the beginning. My neighbors were somehow like a month into this, you know, when it got real bad that first month or two and there was nothing anywhere, were able to find a spare pack of toilet paper in a store, and they brought it over to us. I happened to be some friends with some farmers out here. I live in a very rural area, guys. I happen to be friends with some farmers that, you know, have their farm stands all out here. I managed to find fresh fruit. Which
that's wild.
Here in the deep south is like our produce was completely gone. Like nothing.
Yeah.
You couldn't find anything. I found a fresh pineapple, and in payment for the toilet paper, I brought over this cut up fresh pineapple I had just chilled, and all of them were like, we don't even like pineapple, but we sat there and it was like a literal food orgy with this bowl of pineapple, because it felt so decadent to have fresh produce for the first time in like months. I mean, it was all nothing but like just nom, nom. Oh God, this is the best thing I've ever had in my life. I don't even like pineapple, but this is the best thing ever.
Well,
and then, you know, after eating too much pineapple and getting sick. Exactly.
That's how I felt. I mean, it was just a crazy time, and it still is a little bit. And but anyway, both of that book, it's illustrated, and it's just like a little golden book, basically. But it has all sorts of movie references, like the grocery store clerk. I had the illustrator draw him to look like Peter Lorre, and we have homages to Carrie, the little connection to De Palma, and The Sound of Music, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's really fun for film fans. And both of these books are actually, all the profits are going to the World Health Organization's COVID-19 Solidarity Response Fund. And that is the same charity that when Lady Gaga did her big TV special back in April, when at the beginning of the pandemic, to raise money, that was the organization that she chose. And I just thought, you know, they vetted it, and this sounds like a great thing, and it's for everybody around the world. And so I decided that was what I was going to donate all the profits from these two books. And they're both available in paperback and in Kindle ebook on Amazon. That's the only place you can find them, is to order it from Amazon. And you can just look up my name, Sam Irvin, I-R-V-I-N, and look, you know, or Sam's Toilet Paper Caper. Now, there is one little tricky thing. Orbigasm is considered adult, and I didn't adult books are not in the regular search for all products in Amazon. I had no idea. So when you go to Amazon, you don't have to find an adult section. All you have to do is find the book section, and then when you type it in, Orbgasm, O-R-B-gasm, by Sam Irvin, then it will come right up. It'll be the first thing. But if you do it in the regular search, it doesn't come up, which is really strange and frustrating, because, you know, people of all ages can look in the book section. So I don't know why, but that's just a little quirk. So when you're trying to find it, you just have to go to the book section.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to move on here a little bit, because there's something else I think our listeners will want to hear, and that's how you got involved as co-producer of Gods and Monsters.
Oh, yes. Well, The Bride of Frankenstein is my favorite film of all time, and it was directed by a gay director named James Whale, who was just a fantastic director. He did the original Frankenstein, the Boris Karloff, and then Bride of Frankenstein. He also did The Invisible Man and Old Dark House. Just an amazing director, and I so idolize him. And I read a book, a novel called Father of Frankenstein, that imagined James Whale's later in life when he retired and became an artist. And which is all true, but the book was, you know, based on truth, and he actually ended up committing suicide, very sadly. And the book sort of imagines all of the things that led up to his suicide. And the book was so moving to me. I just absolutely loved it. And it had flashbacks of Whale making The Bride of Frankenstein and things. And it was just fascinating on so many levels. And I got in touch with the author, and I said, I'd love to option this book and see if I could direct it. And he said, well, unfortunately, a guy named Bill Condon just beat you to the punch. He optioned it a couple weeks ago. Well, I happen to know Bill through my friend Nancy Allen, Brian De Palma's wife, by then ex-wife, and I had actually directed Nancy in a Showtime thriller called Acting on Impulse. And I had met Bill Condon at a couple of her parties, because he had directed her in a film and written one of her other films. So I called up Bill and I said, you know, congratulations on getting Father Frankenstein, and have you thought about Ian McKellen to play James Whale? And he said, oh my God, we are totally on the same wavelength. That's exactly who I want for it. And I've sent him a copy of the book, and I'm waiting to see if he responds to it. Well, he obviously did. And about a year later, I was in prep to direct a film that I had written called Kiss of a Stranger, that starred Mariel Hemingway, Diane Cannon, and David Carradine, at a production company called Region Entertainment. And I heard the head of the company, Paul Kolishman, out in the hallway, and he mentioned this book, Father of Frankenstein. And I jumped up out of my desk and ran out there and said, what's going on? And he said, oh, well, this guy named Bill Condon has submitted a script that he's written of this book, and they have Ian McKellen attached. And I'm like, oh my God, you have to do this movie. And if you do it, I have to be one of the producers and work on it. And so it all worked out, and they ended up making the movie, and it ended up being retitled Gods and Monsters. And it was picked up for distribution by Lionsgate. And it became, when it opened in November, it actually opened 20 years ago this month, and it opened, and the National Board of Review are usually the first of the awards. They sort of kick off the award season, and they announced their awards that year, and they gave Gods and Monsters Best Picture, Best Actor for Ian McKellen, Best Supporting Actress for Lynn Redgrave, Best Director for Bill Condon, and Best Screenplay for Bill Condon. It just swept the entire award. And then other critics' awards were awarding the film various different awards. And then the Golden Globes, it got nominated for several Golden Globes and won the Golden Globe for Lynn Redgrave for Best Supporting Actress. And then it got three Oscar nominations for Best Actor, Ian McKellen, Best Supporting Actress, Lynn Redgrave, and Best Adapted Screenplay by Bill Condon. And it won for the Best Screenplay Award, which we just were so thrilled about. And it was just this magic, magic film. And I made sure that when they did the flashback of James Whale on the set of Bride of Frankenstein, that we recreated the Frankenstein laboratory in a studio in Los Angeles, the Lacey Studios downtown. We recreated it exactly, and I wanted it to be perfect, and we managed to track down the original electrical equipment that had been used in the original Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, and it had also Mel Brooks had tracked it down and used it in Young Frankenstein. So that equipment, you know, is in three of the greatest movies of all time, in my opinion. And it just made the hair on the back of my neck stand up to be able to just see and touch that equipment and to work on, you know, recreating that moment in the film when James Whale is seen directing this scene. And we found an actress, Rosalind Ayers, who looks exactly like Elsa Lanchester, and had her all done up with the hair teased way up. And oh my God, it was a dream come true, just absolute dream come true.
Yeah, I mean, that should be amazing in terms of seeing that. I know when I was a kid and I saw Frankenstein for the first time, and that was on Chiller Theater in Pittsburgh. I literally was crying at the end of the original, not Brides, but
yeah,
Frankenstein. You know, and for what we call Monster Kid, you know, that was so important to connect to the creature. And then of course, you know, with Gods and Monsters, we're not just connecting with the creature, but the director and the whole person behind it, and a sad story. So you have that, you know, parallel.
Well,
one of go ahead.
It's a really good, I couldn't agree more. And when I was a kid and saw Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein, you know, the monster is called a monster, but he's not. The monster is really Dr. Frankenstein, who creates this being and then abandons him. And the poor creature is just this misunderstood freak of nature. And I identified with that. And I think that outsiders of all types, shapes, colors, you name it, anybody who's been bullied, anybody who's felt like an outsider, whether it's gay people, whether it's just us monster kid nerds, whatever, we've all been bullied, we've all been misunderstood, we've all had those moments of feeling like we were freaks of nature. I certainly did as a young closeted gay kid, and it just spoke to me. I don't think I realized how deeply it spoke to me until much later when I was an adult and looking back on it, but I could see why I so identified with this poor creature. And that's why the Frankenstein movies, but particularly Bride of Frankenstein, has always stuck with me and been such an important influence on my entire life. There was a miniseries, a Frankenstein miniseries called Frankenstein, The True Story in 1973 that Universal did. And this took the queer subtext to a whole new level. And it was written by, it was adapted, or, you know, the screenplay was written by Christopher Isherwood and Don Bacardi, one of the most famous gay couples of all time. Christopher Isherwood wrote the book, The Berlin Stories, that Cabaret was based on. He wrote a Single Man that Colin Firth starred in and got nominated for an Oscar. And his partner, Don Bacardi, who's a world-renowned portrait artist, they wrote the script, and there was a gay producer, Hunt Stromberg Jr., who had discovered Vampyra in the 50s, and he helped launch the Munsters, and, you know, he had a whole big horror, you know, he was a horror kid, a monster kid like us, and Bride of Frankenstein was his favorite film of all time. And anyway, he was pushing the gay agenda and wanted these writers to load up the film with as much gay subtext as possible to get it and still get on the air with NBC in prime time in 1973. So it had to be subtext back in those days, but it's very much there. And when I saw that at age 17, I was just blown away. They cast the most beautiful actor, Leonard Whiting, to play Dr. Frankenstein. He was only about 22 at the time, and he had played Romeo in Zeffirelli's beautiful production of Romeo and Juliet. And the creature was played by Michael Sarrazin. And in this, uniquely in this film, it was the first time this had ever been done, when Dr. Frankenstein brings the creature to life, the creature is actually beautiful at first. And there was very much this queer subtext between the doctor and his creature and this beautiful, stunning creature that he had. And the writers actually put in sort of this Pygmalion, My Fair Lady sort of thing, where the doctor is teaching the creature manners and how to eat and how to be a gentleman and how to present him in high society. And it's just beautiful. It's just, and it's very touching. Well, then what starts to happen is that the creature's skin starts to deteriorate and he starts to become very gnarly and very ugly. And Dr. Frankenstein abandons him. And it's heartbreaking. Oh my God. If you thought, you know, it was heartbreaking in the original Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, this is 10 times more than that. And anyway, that miniseries just touched me in a really profound way. And at that time, when I was 17, I was editing and publishing my own fanzine called Bizarre, as we talked about. And I put Frankenstein, the True Story, on the cover. And when I went to England, I managed to track down some of the people who were in it, like Jane Seymour, who played the female creature that they bring to life. And I had dinner with her and interviewed her for my magazine. Okay, so then flash forward about 40 years to about 2015 or so. The editor of a magazine called Little Shop of Horrors got in touch with me and said, I know you love this miniseries, Frankenstein, the True Story. We want to cover it in the magazine. Will you write about it? And I said, well, I've written about it before. If you would give me the entire issue, I will go to town and do a whole making of that will absolutely knock your socks off. And so he allowed me to take over the reins of the magazine and do an entire 120-page study of the film, and it's got 400 photographs. I interviewed Jane Seymour again, and I interviewed Leonard Whiting, who's Dr. Frankenstein, and David McCallum, who was in it, and many of the other actors, and about 20 of the crew people. And it's and I ended up winning the Rondo Award for Best Article of the Year, which I'm so proud of. And that magazine, oh, I also got Anne Rice to write the foreword because it was the movie that had inspired her to write Interview with the Vampire. It was just this magical thing, and it's an incredible issue, and you can get it by going to littleshopofhorrors.com. And Little Shop is spelled the old-fashioned way. Shop is spelled S-H-O-P-P-E. So just www.littleshopofhorrors.com. And it's issue number 38, completely devoted to Frankenstein, the true story. Now that, and after I won the award and everything, led to Shout Factory approaching me to do all the extras for a brand new, restored and upgraded 2K beautiful Frankenstein, the true story Blu-ray that just came out this year, April of 2020. And I did all the extras for it. I interviewed Jane Seymour a third time, now on camera. And I went to London.
You have a thing for Jane Seymour here. I'm starting to see a pattern.
Yes, a definite pattern. And she actually made, you know, and it connects with the Bond girl thing. She was a Bond girl in Live and Let Die, and actually 3 days after she finished shooting that movie, went right into shooting Frankenstein, the true story at the same studio, at Pinewood Studios in London. And but at any rate, I also went to London and interviewed on camera Leonard Whiting, who was Dr. Frankenstein. And I also did the co-writer, Don Bacardi. And so all those extras are on the Blu-ray. And it's a three-hour movie. And I did a three-hour audio commentary to beat all audio commentaries. It's just incredible. I'm so proud of it. And it's very dishy, and it goes into all of the queer subtext. And it also talks about all of the machinations of getting the film made. It was, at that time, in 1973, it was the most expensive horror movie ever made. It was the most expensive TV movie ever made. It was a big, big deal. And there were a lot of big people who wanted to direct it. Francis Ford Coppola begged to direct it, and this was right after he had won the Oscar for The Godfather. He was at the height of his career and could do, you know, he could do anything he wanted. But Universal was afraid of him because he had gone $1 million over budget on The Godfather, and so they wouldn't let him do it. But all kinds
they
of
they couldn't
stories
afford to.
So, yeah, exactly. So, but anyway, you've got to check it out. It's definitely, if you watch the film, get this Blu-ray because it looks better than it has ever looked. I mean, the resolution and the colors and everything is just, it's much more beautiful than when it first aired on NBC, because the technology now and the resolution that we can get with these Blu-rays is just so much better. So anyway, it's a really remarkable thing. And I'm going to be expanding all of the stuff that I've done with that into a big coffee table book. And so that's sort of on the horizon. So anyway, that's
real. You are busy beyond belief, my friend. Good Lord.
Like, seriously. I thought we were all supposed to be quarantining. Here this guy is
Well, sometimes that works. You know, you quarantine, you got all sorts of things you can do. So I want to move on here a little bit and just get into a couple other things.
Sure.
One is your relationship with Elvira, because you certainly not only have a relationship with her, you've done several movies with her, correct?
Well, I've done two. I huge, huge fan of Elvira, and with her, you know, hosting horror movies back in the 80s, and then her first film, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, I was a huge fan of that. And then right after I did my first feature film as a director, it was called Guilty as Charged with Rod Steiger and Lauren Hutton.
Which is not available on any platform right now. And
I know, it's so
I want to
frustrating
see it.
Right now.
Yeah, and that sucks because I love that movie. I love that film.
It's a dark comedy about a madman who kidnaps murderers and fries them in his own electric shaft. And I had so much fun doing it, and it was, you know, it was a horror, you know, it was a horror film in its own way. And I really made the dungeon and the electric chair and everything very German expressionistic and very much inspired by the James Whale Frankenstein sort of vibe. And so anyway, it was really fun to do that. Well, I went to a Hollywood party It was hosted by Terry Sweeney, who was used to be on Saturday Night Live in the 80s. And he, in fact, Terry was the first openly gay member of the Saturday Night Live cast, and he always did Nancy Reagan in drag. Okay, so he, I go to this party. I see Cassandra Peterson, who's Elvira, sitting in the far corner of the room. And I ran over to Terry and I said, "Oh my God, I didn't know you knew Cassandra. Please introduce me." So he introduced me to her and I fawned and said how much I loved Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And then Terry said, "Well, Sam has just directed a film called Guilty as Charged." And she goes, "Oh, I love that movie. In fact, if I do another Elvira film, I want you to direct it." And I was like, "What?" And I wasn't quite sure if she'd had too much to drink or what. And, but we became friends, and I asked her to play a cameo in my next film. It was called Acting on Impulse. It was a Scream Queen whodunit thriller that starred Nancy Allen. And Cassandra plays a bouncer at a country western bar, and she borrowed a blonde wig from Daryl Hannah and did this sort of Dolly Parton sort of character, and it was hilarious. And so then several years go by, and then Cassandra calls me up, and she said, "You know, everybody in town has turned me down to do an Elvira movie, so my husband and I, we're going to finance it ourselves. We're going to mortgage our house and everything, but we want you to come over and meet with us about possibly directing it. We are considering some other people, but I've always promised you you'd be considered for sure." So I went over there, and she handed me the script, and she said, "This is Elvira's Haunted Hills. It's a spoof of the Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe movies of the 1960s that Roger Corman directed, like Sit in the Pendulum, House of Usher, Tomb of Ligeia, Haunted Palace, the whole thing." And she goes, "Are you familiar with those?" And I said, "Cassandra, of course I am. I know them backwards and forwards. In fact, this is Vincent Price's monologue from the climax of Pit in the Pendulum." And I started into it. I said, "Do you know where you are, Bartolomeo? You are about to enter hell. Hell, the Neverworld, the infernal region, the abode of the damned, a place of torment, the Gehenna, Naraka, the pit, and the pendulum, the razor edge of destiny. Thus the condition of man, bound on an island from which he can never hope to escape, surrounded by the waiting pit of hell, which must destroy him finally." And she looked at me like I was nuts. And then she said, "You're hired." So that's literally how I got that job. And I had memorized that in junior high school for a little assignment that the teacher had given us that she wanted everybody to do, to recite a monologue. Well, of course, it had to be very academic. And so people were choosing, you know, Shakespeare and whatever. And I could care less about that. And I said, "Could I do Edgar Allan Poe?" And that sounded academic enough. So that the teacher said yes. And so I ran home, and I had Sit in the Pendulum. I had recorded it, the sound. This is long before VHS or video or anything. I had recorded it on a reel-to-reel audio tape off the TV speaker, and I transcribed that monologue, which, of course, was not written by Edgar Allan Poe. It was written by the screenwriter, Richard Matheson, but I wasn't about to tell them that. And I went in and recited it and got an A, and I just remembered that all my life to this day, and it got me the job. And Elvira's Haunted Hills was the most fun I've ever had making a movie. We shot it in Romania. We built the most amazing sets, this huge Pit in the Pendulum set, huge castle sets and everything. We had not only Elvira, but Richard O'Brien from the Rocky Horror Picture Show playing the sort of Vincent Price character who owned the castle. And it was just this magical, magical time. I absolutely loved it. And next year is the 20th anniversary, and it is coming out on Blu-ray from Shout Factory, which I'm really excited about. Yeah, so that's just so excited about that. So everybody will be able to see it in all its glory next year.
Elvira,
oh, that's great.
Always one of my favorite things as a kid. I mean, obviously still is, but it's really what got me into horror movies when I was younger. But that's probably also why I love horror comedy so much. And a lot of times your horror thriller movies do have that comedic element, which really makes me appreciate things. Actually, you have a lot of comedic element in all of your movies that I've seen so far.
I always see the humor in Egg, and I love that mixture. I love mixing the humor with horror and with serious stuff.
And I can see that.
And everything I do, it really is. You're absolutely right. That I guess that's one of my trademarks.
Like, Cassandra seems like she would be somebody really fun to work with. And
she's
not only fun to work with, but
she is one of my closest friends. I mean, I absolutely worship that woman. She's so funny, so talented, so nice, and so down to earth. And when you see how she treats her fans, when she goes to conventions and stuff, she's just so down to earth, so approachable, so nice to everybody. I can't say enough great things about her.
I personally don't know any of those things. I just know how, like, I've done my research and stuff. I've looked into her. And I hear that she's, you know, a really nice person, but it's kind of like you can see that. And I just have always thought since my childhood that she would probably have been really fun to work with, because if you make a movie like Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, or The Haunted Hills, you've definitely got to have a really good sense of humor. And that makes me appreciate people.
Exactly.
So, again, really jealous of you.
So I want to get into one more thing before we get off. I don't want to get you too long into the show, but I do want to talk about what you're doing now. You know, you've hooked up specifically with Hallmark, and how did that happen, and how is it working out, and so on and so forth? Because I don't know how many Christmas movies you've done, but you've done a slew.
I think I'm off track. It's about seven or eight of them now. A few years ago, I started working as a director for two or three different production companies that have deals with Hallmark and with Lifetime to do thrillers for Lifetime, but occasionally Christmas movies for Lifetime. And then with Hallmark, it's mostly Christmas movies, but sometimes a bride movie or a romantic comedy that are not Christmas related. And so anyway, I'm not really working directly for the networks, but I'm working for these production companies who make a product for the network. And I got into it, and I guess I do a good job in terms of staying on schedule and on budget, which is always a good thing. And I love making these movies, whether it's the thrillers or the Christmas movies. I just have a blast doing it. And it's very tight schedules, very tight budgets, but I love those challenges. And I'm really, you know, I've done over 40 movies now as a director, and they've all been in the sort of low budget realm. So I've gotten really, really clever and good at how to maximize the, you know, little bit of money to make it look 10 times better than it has any right to look. And they keep inviting me back. So I must be doing something right. And before this pandemic, I was doing like 4, 5, 6 of these a year. And I just love it. I absolutely love it. So at this stage in my career, I consider myself a director for hire. What I love to do is get a call, and the script is ready to go. They've got the financing. They've got an air date, you know, which is definitely going to get released. And they'll make me an offer, and I jump right into pre-production, and we shoot it, and I turn in my director's cut, and boom, and then I'm on to the next thing. And I love that quick in and out. I hate development hell.
You just like to do the damn thing.
Yeah, I like to direct. That's what I want to do. I don't want to do all the other stuff. I don't want to be developing the script. I don't want to be looking for the money. I don't want to be taking it around to festivals hoping that it's going to get picked up for distribution. You know, I hate all of that. I just want to be on a set calling action. And
that
that's
was,
what the
that was actually one of my questions earlier for you.
Yeah.
Looking into everything, it's either you do these crazy, like, sci-fi mysteries, thrillers, suspense kind of movies, or Christmas movies.
Yes. The two extremes. Oh, I'm either killing people or giving them presents, you know.
Exactly. But I will say that the Christmas movies I've seen of yours, the person that was my Santa confession, I do admit I had to go back through and look at my conversation, but the Santa confession was about my gentleman who was actually excited to watch Christmas movies with some director he didn't know about. He's not into remembering names and things like I am from things, so
yeah.
He probably couldn't even tell you the lead singer's name of his favorite band. So it's not that you've been a bad director, but I was just really stoked that I was like, okay, so I've got to watch some Hallmark Christmas movies because these are the ones I can find right now. And again, I was so happy, and apparently some of them are now his new favorites too. So just to let you know that you do crazy psycho thriller suspense well, and also Christmas movies.
Well, thank you. With the Christmas movies, I always feel like, you know, people are just surfing through the channels when they hit. I always feel like no matter what moment they hit, when they see one of my Christmas movies playing, I want it to just scream Christmas. And so I load up every single shot that I possibly can with as much Christmas decor and Christmas lights and Christmas trees and everything as possible.
I keep going back to this one, but like Naughty and Nice, you also load them up with packing peanuts.
Yes, exactly. But
there was a packing peanut snowman.
Yes, exactly right. I hold the record of the most Christmas trees in one living room set that has ever appeared in a Hallmark film, and that was 11. And
wow,
nice.
That's almost that. I have to see
My Christmas Prince. Yes, and so whenever I start a Christmas movie and I'm working with a new art director or whatever, I always say, okay, just know that I've squeezed 11 Christmas trees into one room, and so you better have a lot of Christmas trees on that truck. Just you know, have at least 15, maybe 20, because I'm always going to be saying, okay, I'll just walk into a set and I'll say, okay, here's where we want the Christmas trees. There. So that no matter what angle, what close-up, no matter what, there's always going to be Christmas decor in the background. And Hallmark loves that, and Lifetime as well. Actually, My Christmas Prince was made for Lifetime, because they also do Christmas movies. It's the holiday season. But anyway, I love doing them. It's so much fun. But I will say this. There have been years where I directed two Christmas movies. By the time real Christmas comes along, I am so over Christmas.
Well, of course you are. That makes sense. You know, I have to say something here, but anyone who does film titles like Fatal Acquittal, I'm Not Ready for Christmas, you know, My Daughter Vanished, Homecoming Revenge, and Check Into Christmas, The Christmas Food Order. Okay,
yeah,
but anyone who does all those titles, I have to think of the old Robin Williams line, let's talk about schizophrenia. No, let's not. Okay.
It does seem that way, for sure.
But that's the thing about being a director. That's the thing about being a director for hire. You know, you do the projects, you go in, you do your job, you go to the next one. And that's a wonderful way of doing it. And there are so many people that do that. Of course, Fred Olin Ray, Chris Ray, and so on and so forth. And that's a very valid way to work. And anyone who takes a look at it and say, you know, sort of like looks down at the project, they can go fuck themselves as far as I'm concerned, because you're working and you're doing the work and they're not. Trust me.
And well, frankly, they keep coming back because you're doing a good job. So, I mean.
Well, and it just goes back to the thing. I want to work. And so I love doing these films. I do not in any way look down at it. And it allows me the freedom that between projects, I can do the labor of love writing that I do, writing my books, writing for magazines, writing, you know, things about movies that I love. And so it's a perfect balance. I love it. I absolutely love it. There were many years in the past when I would be, you know, caught up in development hell, and I would spend, you know, 3 years trying to get something off the ground, and then it never would happen. And you look back on those 3 years of just such waste, and, you know, I just can't do that anymore. I don't have it in me. I want to know that the stuff that I'm doing is getting out there and, you know, coming to fruition. And so that's why being a director for hire, and I'm very, very blessed and lucky to be in a position after being in this business since 1978 to finally be on the list of, you know, getting calls pretty regularly to do stuff. It wasn't always that way, and I don't take it for granted at all, but it really gives me the luxury of, you know, just waiting for the calls to come in and not having to go out and pound the pavement and look for work, which is a pretty dream cushy place to be.
Absolutely. Sam, I want to thank you so much for being on. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Before you go, let's do another plug for everything you've got out there.
Okay, well, my latest novel, Orbgasm, and my children's book parody, Sam's Toilet Paper Caper, both of those are available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. The Frankenstein, the True Story study that I did in Little Shop of Horrors magazine, number 38, and that's at www.littleshopofhorrors.com, shop spelled S-H-O-P-P-E. And the new Blu-ray of Frankenstein, the True Story with all my extras is available now from Shout Factory. You can get it on Amazon or go to Shout Factory's site. And all my Christmas movies are being rerun at the moment. If you're on Facebook, I'm on there. I just posted a whole schedule of where they're going to when and what time they're going to be playing on Hallmark and Lifetime. And so, you know, that should give you plenty to delve into.
Absolutely. So I want to just do a little bit of house cleaning right now. For those that are listening, either this afternoon as we're live or tonight, tomorrow on Deviant and Legion, Mika is going to come back with the Diva Hour. And she's going to be doing a show on the Hulu movie Black Hair, or Bad Hair, excuse me. And we're calling it Bad Hair, Bad Movie, and Other Thoughts. And she'll be talking about that. I also watched the film. I've seen better, trust me. And then on Friday, Adam is going to come in on Cathode Ray Mission. And he will be doing a show on films of Wes Anderson. So that'll be really good. And on Sunday, Danae is taking off on Sunday. So we don't have anything specifically set for next week, but we have some things working. And hopefully next week we'll be able to start our guests coming in from out of the country because we've got something hooked up for them now. So that's going to happen very soon. So we want to thank everyone for listening. Again, Sam, thank you so, so much for everything. And Rachel, do you have any last words before we get out of here?
Thank you again so much, Mr. Sam Ervin, because this has been a very transcendently joyous experience. You are an amazingly talented individual, and I appreciate you taking your time for us because, wow, like, your movie career and the reason you got into this, it's just like a serendipitous series of wonderful blessings, and I am so glad that they happened to you when they did.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been really, really fun.
Okay, and Sam, just to make sure you know this, you are welcome back anytime. All you have to do is message me and let me know what you got going. No question.
Cool. I appreciate it. All right.
All right. Well, I'm going to, again, thank everyone for listening, and we will see you next week at the ISF. And again, thanks, Sam. Thanks, Rachel. This has been really fun. So everyone say good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Stay safe.
Good night, Johnny.
Stay
yes,
safe.
Don't let the bed bugs bite.
Yeah.
Good night, people.
All right. Thanks so much. Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye, Sam.